Well, last week, Jisho spoke about the first precept, not taking life. Today I'm going to talk about the second one, the second precept. And you'll hear more about it if you're in the Roxu sewing class this afternoon. So, the second precept, which is very simply, in its simplest statement, don't steal. But the phrase, do not steal, sounds too much like an admonition when you're a child from an adult. Not to take cookies when you're not given permission to, or don't take the change you find laying on the table that your mother accidentally left laying there. It sounds like that. And very simple. So we all assume we know exactly what do not steal means. But do we? I'm going to be very confrontational today on purpose, just to get us to think about this. Because I think that, and I include myself in this, we're all habitual thieves. And who steal shamelessly and unthinkingly. Well, I make that provocative statement, hoping that it makes you look much more closely at this precept and realize that our days are filled with various forms of thievery. That we excuse that thievery with remarks like, well, that's just the normal way it's done. Or, that's the way everyone lives. That's just how it's done in our culture. That's just acceptable forms of being a thief in our culture. Well, so let's look more closely at what I'm talking about here. And I do hope that your hackles are up a little bit. Nobody wants to be called a thief. That's a dirty word. Especially all of us who, probably most of us in this room, think of ourselves as very law-abiding citizens who are politically correct most of the time and who are savvy about environmental affairs and being a good citizen, all of these things. So that would tend to put us in a category where we might think we're above having to think about this precept. And almost certainly we're persons who, if we found a billfold on the street, would immediately find the telephone number and call the person and get it back to them. Or if the cashier at the supermarket gave us an extra $10 bill, when we realized it, we would immediately give it back to them. I mean, we're that kind of people, right? We're good people. So we always see ourselves as people who are not about to take anything that isn't given to us, which is another way this precept is certain, sometimes stated, not taking that which is not freely given. But if we look more deeply into the ramifications of this precept, I think most of us would feel more than a little uncomfortable with some of the more shadowy areas of our activity, of our behavior, and especially those where we unthinkingly go along with the greed and social injustice of our particular culture. So, if we are to take this, the precepts seriously, as one of the really great, beautiful gifts of the Buddha Dharma, which is what you realize as time goes by when you live with the precepts, they're incredibly kind to us and understanding of our flaws as human beings, and try to give us some insight into how we can gradually learn to live without wandering off into the rough country of breaking the precepts. We need to see just how culpable we are, even when we know we are on shaky ground and are giving in a little to expediency and our natural acquisitiveness. So, are you finding this talk a little bit threatening and perhaps even a little bit insulting? Well, actually, join the human race. Because we all feel that way, because we know in some ways that we're on shaky ground with the precepts. That somehow there are areas in which we're fudging it. But Buddhism, you got to remember, is not a punitive religion. The Buddha's not saying, you're bad. Not at all. As a matter of fact, what he's saying is, I understand human behavior. We all have these problems. That's why I gave you the precepts, to help us in these areas where we tend to get into trouble. And even though we fail at observing them, we look at ourselves and we treat ourselves with loving kindness. We don't go, oh, you're terrible. No, it's, oh, I tried not to get into this kind of difficulty and I see I'm here. I'll try harder next time. That's how we're supposed to take the precepts. So we need to treat ourselves with loving kindness, but firmly, realistically, look at what we do. The two go together. One without the other doesn't work. And we need to have the same feeling about everybody else. Everybody else is in the same boat we're in. They needed to be treated with loving kindness, and yet they don't really need to be let off the hook either. We're all simply flawed human beings. It comes down to that. That's why we're here. Something in us senses that and thinks, I need the help of the Dharma. I need the help of the three treasures to feel right about my living. I mean, I think that's why most people come to a group like this. Now, this is a vow which is not exactly by Thich Nhat Hanh, but he influenced the creation of it. And I can't really remember exactly who. I think it was the Peace Fellowship who sort of rewrote the 10 grave precepts. And this is what they came up with. Aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression, I vow to cultivate loving kindness and learn ways to work for the well-being of people, animals, and plants. That's their version of the precept of not stealing. And even though it does concern this not stealing, stealing is only one of the set of activities that Thich Nhat Hanh listed there. I hope you noticed that. So under that same rubric of not stealing was what? Social injustice, exploitation, oppression. So now maybe you begin to see why I think we all need to look more deeply at this idea of do not steal. John Dido Lurie went even further, and in his list of things that he included under the rubric do not steal are machinations, grabbing, controlling, and dominating. All of our squabbling and struggling to get, to hoard, to take. So that's all stealing. Well, that does give us a lot of room for maneuvering, doesn't it? It's not just simple as don't take the change off the counter and don't steal the cookies out of the cookie jar. So let's look at some of these variations on the theme of stealing, beginning with exploitation. Nowadays we hear a lot about exploitation, but usually in terms of the environment, how we're exploiting and stealing from the environment in order to gratify our comfort and our every little whim. We pollute the air unthinkingly because we have to drive to the store 15 times a day because we don't stop and think about what we're doing. But they're saying this is a form of stealing. And we've got this really beautiful example of it we've just been through with the oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. The enormous, we don't call it thievery, but the thievery there, I mean, people's lives, their incomes, the wildlife, all kinds of things were stolen in the name of a very careless, and I don't say it was wrong to drill the oil well, but it comes out there was all this carelessness and let's push ahead, you know, which is a form of greed. We got to get this done so we can start making money off of it. And so, yes, this is stealing. But there are a lot of forms of exploitation. How about slavery? Well, I don't think any of us in this room probably own any slaves today, but the slave trade is alive and well in the world, and we profit from it. Right here, because we as Americans are very greedy at using and getting as many of the resources of the labors of people as we can get. And there was a great to-do for a while about prison labor in China producing a lot of the goods that we were greedily buying at very low prices. I think perhaps that's not as serious a problem as it was, but we were profiting from that. So we're collaborators in that kind of stealing. And then let's look at where we live. And now I start getting heated because this is one of my hot areas. Most of us are living on land that once belonged to Pomo and Miwok Indians and a few other tribes on the periphery. Now, how did we get that? Well, if you read the stories, the historical stories about how we got that, it's horrifying. Like the massacre at Usal Harbor up in the Sinkyone, where they came in on horses and just ran everybody out, men, women, and children, into the ocean. But we're profiting from that thievery. So, you know, we should have that in our consciousness when we sit on our piece of land that we own, that is mine, and you'd better stay off of it. It's good to remember these things from time to time. And right next door, we have the Centro Laboral, and these are mainly Mexican laborers who are trying to desperately find jobs to feed their family, who are being exploited as cheap labor. That's certainly a form of exploitation. And we may not be directly exploiting them, but we are. And what have we done in our lives to mitigate this? Well, if you're really interested in this, speak to Liz. She gathers food from people to give to the... it is the Centro Laboral, isn't that what it's called? For those families who are out of work to help feed their children. So there's ways. And this is what Thich Nhat Hanh said. He said, as you'll remember, instead of exploiting these people, he says, I vow to cultivate loving kindness and learn ways to work for the well-being of people, animals, and plants. So anyhow, let's go to the next one that Thich Nhat Hanh spoke of. He says, social injustice. How does that come under the precept, do not steal? Well, it becomes clear if you remember the standard image of justice we have in America as a blindfolded woman holding a set of scales in which you weigh money and food and stuff like that. It has a direct, our ideas of justice are really tied up with ideas of stealing and ownership and all that stuff. So a great deal of social injustice comes about because of the ability of the powerful and the wealthy, which includes us, really, in terms of the world, the rest of the world, to buy or extort favorable legal and governmental protection. And this is a very direct form of stealing. But it masquerades as legality and seems to be built into our way of life in our culture. And we may condemn it in principle, but many of us profit from it nonetheless, especially when we make out our income tax forms. I mean, that's where it's really, you really feel so justified in cheating, in stealing. So, you know, it's there. But the next one you might really well ask, how did it get there in this precept? And that's oppression. Isn't that something else? Well, no. A little thought on the subject. And you think you may see that where else are you going to put stealing in the precepts? This form of stealing, oppression, this oppression in the precepts. Oppression is stealing other people's lives from them in order to enrich yourself. It's stealing lives. Either in the form of goods or in power. When I was thinking about this talk, I realized I found it really interesting, and I've thought about this before, that on our $20 bill, which is nowadays what anything at least costs, I mean, you can't hand anything out like in $1 or $5 or $10. You know, you hand out a 20 and then you get some change back, right? So that $20 bill is right in front of you all the time. And whose picture is on it? Andrew Jackson. He was a really sweet guy. As a matter of fact, he was a total thug. And he's the one who drove the Cherokees and the Choctaws and all those the so-called civilized tribes of the Southeast out of their lands walked them across to Oklahoma on what is known as the Trail of Tears, on which enormous numbers of them died, and took their lands and said, and then he was very popular, gave it to who else? You and me. Well, that's oppression and that's stealing. And there his portrait is, right there on our money. And what else is on that money? In God we trust. But we'll look after ourselves first. Thank you. Well, I feel like this talk's getting a little overheated. And, you know, that happens when you start pointing the finger at other people's failure in these areas. So the cure for that is, let's come back to ourselves, just directly to ourselves. And let's point the finger at ourselves and own up to our difficulties in dealing with this precept of not stealing. And a good place to begin looking is at the expression that all contain the word own, I own. And it belongs to me. I own it. And even, let's get down deeper into the language, and words like my and mine. We never pay attention to those words. They just flip by. But perhaps if your Zazen sometimes gets carried into your daily life, you've noticed that around those words and expressions, there's very often a little emotional aura. They're not just neutral words. Sometimes they have a little aura of pride around them. Mine. My child who's succeeding. My lovely home. Pride, okay? How about shame? My dirty living room. That's not well taken care of. Or exaltation. It's mine. I want it. Or anger. Defensiveness. Well, it is, after all, mine. And I can do what I want to with it. And these feelings are not separate from those words that I'm using, like me, mine, my, and my, what I own. And here we really see ourselves very attached to what we possess, even that which we don't like. We're possessive of it. And we're uncomfortable with it. We feel uncomfortable with it. Now, the reason I think that we're a little uncomfortable around this is that we realize that there's something off here, because we've taken me with my and mine, and we've made a complete division with it from you and yours, or us and ours. And we're getting into a kind of area of alienation. All around this possession business. So we tend to feel like people are always trying to take from us, move in on us, steal from us, without using that word necessarily. So perhaps ownership isn't all it's cut out to be. Maybe this is not safety. That's usually what we feel, is you're safe because of your, what you own is like a wall that is protecting you from all those doubtful ones out there. But in building that wall, aren't you perhaps alienating yourself from the world? Look at it. I'm just making suggestions. And I don't know that you've ever had this experience, but I've had it a number of times, especially around my home. And I wonder if maybe I'm not owned by my possessions rather than the other way around. Surely you must all feel like that at some point or other. Oh my God, all this stuff I've got. At the same time, it's your bulwark against invasion from outside. You feel suffocated and overwhelmed by it. Oh, all the responsibility. So maybe that's one to look at when the next time it comes up in yourself, because maybe it's true. Just change the, what is the word in chemistry, the plus and the negatives on, you know.
Charge.
Yeah, on it, and see it. The valence. Yeah, the valence. Well, anyhow, I want to end this talk, this provocative, unpleasant talk, where I've tried to put, insert a little bit of humor about Dogen's definition of this precept, do not steal. And as usual, it's not easy to understand what Dogen's saying, but it really is quite important to gradually try to tackle Dogen, try to understand what he's saying. And about this, he says, not stealing, when mind, and we could use the word self there, the real self, and objects, anything outside of what you consider me, are seen as thusness, as just what is, without laying me and mine and you and yours on it. Just, this is it. The gate of liberation is open. That's an interesting statement. That's his comment on not stealing. So, but Dogen is speaking from the standpoint of absolute reality here. From the experience of, as Suzuki Roshi used to say, things as it is. Before our mind starts layering what we like, don't like, what we want, don't want on it. Just the pure perception, things as it is in reality. And that's what he's talking about. From that standpoint, we see that self and other are one. There's really no separation. We're all in this together. In this big, vast universe of life, of everything living, we're all completely integrated parts. There's no separation. So, who is there to steal? And what is there to be stolen? There's just this wide open gate of liberation, which basically means freedom from attachment, which means freedom from being nailed down in your own crap with no escape, which is where we usually wind up getting ourselves painted into some corner. No. When you can see the moments, when you can see the world this way, you're totally free. And the true meaning, Buddhist meaning of free, which doesn't mean free to do whatever you feel like, just the opposite. is the freedom to just be. Without being loaded down with all this other stuff. Now, I gave you this rosy, beautiful picture. But the trouble begins when we have to confront that our particular conditioning in life from long before we're born, in our genes, in our training, in our parents' way of treating us, and all of these things, in our the form our body takes, all this stuff rubs up against the conditions we encounter in our life, which means not necessarily what we like or want. Then it becomes very hard to see that beautiful vision of freedom that Dogen gives us when we lay down our stealing. Fortunately, we have this practice of Zazen and the three treasures and the gift of the precepts to help us free ourselves. That's where I want to end the talk.